Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this St. Patrick's Day. And we are absolutely delighted to have Frank Delaney with us again this hour. Frank is the most eloquent man in the world. Accepted last year's invitation, he did, and he celebrates St. Patrick's Day with us again this year. He is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Ireland, and many other books. He was a news reporter for the BBC in Dublin. He covered the troubles in Northern Ireland for a number of years, and he then created the Bookshelf program for the BBC, hosted his own talk show in the early 80s, created Word of Mouth, BBC's program about language. He's written and hosted many documentaries and has created this wonderful thing, a weekly 5-minute podcast, a page-by-page analysis of James Joyce's Ulysses. He this year staged a show for the 100th anniversary of the Easter Rising, which Frank calls the most important moment in Irish history. He said that on our program last year, so we'll be talking about that this hour. We will be hearing W.B. Yeats's Easter Rising 1916 poem, Seamus Heaney's Digging Music during our annual St. Patrick's Day program, and Frank is the kind of mind that can bring almost anything to voice that's in his head, so he's got poems as well that he will be celebrating and bringing to our attention this hour during our annual St. Patrick's Day program. Plus, we'll hear music, so what could be, who could ask for anything more? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to give your contributions to our St. Patrick's Day program. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Please leave your messages there, greetings of the day, and we're also talk at WPR.org. Those are all ways to reach us. Frank, happy St. Patrick's Day.
And you, can you believe it's a year, or do we say that last year as well?
We said it last year as well, Frank.
Oh, my, Kathleen, this is too much. You know, I can't believe the time. I think somebody said to me recently that Einstein pointed out there's absolutely no reason to wonder why time flies as you're getting older. It would, because there's less of it and there's more of you.
I know.
Or something like that.
I know. Isn't it true?
So that's a new kind of relativity.
Yeah, well, I'm delighted to have you. I look forward to this every single year.
I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, I'm so glad. Last year on this show, you talked about the 100th anniversary of the Easter Rising, which you called, Frank, the most important moment in Irish history. And you were doing a show, I think. I know you're going to be on a panel at Oxford University in April on the Rising. Why is it the most important moment in Irish history? And tell me about the show you've done.
The importance of 1916 is it was such a small thing. It was 6 days long, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Patrick Pearse, the leader, surrendered unconditionally to General Lowe, the British commander, on Saturday. And then nothing much happened apart from the fact that all the leaders were rounded up and taken away to a prison camp, and then a bunch of them. 10 days later, they started executing them after kangaroo courts, drumhead court martials, in which there were no defense lawyers and evidence was not taken on their behalf. That's actually what happened. That is the moment when everything changed. The moment when everything changed was when people became outraged. The Rising itself, as it happened on the streets of Dublin, was seen as sort of a kind of tin pot insurrection. Some of these men didn't even carry guns. They had sticks over their shoulders in some cases, and later would get guns when they got to the post office or Liberty Hall or wherever they were going to, or the various points of fighting. But it was the fact that not more than a few hundred men, average age probably, 21, 22, 23, would take on the might of the British Empire while World War I was raging. They didn't call it World War I then. They called it the World War. While that was raging, the daring of that, and then it was the mistake, the cruel mistake of the executions that really stirred everything up. They made martyrs. The British made martyrs of them immediately. And once they did that, stories of all kinds of other related atrocities came out. Then something really interesting happened. George Bernard Shaw was writing a column in a London newspaper. And now people are coming to realize the importance of this. And he had condemned the Rising, almost using the words loutish. He just stopped short of loutish. But when they executed the leaders, Shaw did a complete 180-degree turn and said that this was a heinous crime these men should have been imprisoned or brief punishment and then let go. But because the brutality of the executions, they shot one man in his wheelchair because he'd been injured. He'd wounded James Connolly, the leader of the Citizens Army. He had been wounded and he was in his wheelchair, and they brought him out in a wheelchair in his pajamas and they shot him. And Shaw turned the sympathy not only in Ireland, but to a great degree in Britain and all across the world. The column was syndicated. And then the support grew. And within 2 years, 3 years, Michael Collins was organizing what became the War of Independence from 1919 to 1921, led to the Treaty of December 1921 and the subsequent Civil War, and everything then built towards a new state. Mm-hmm. So it was that, it was a pivotal moment of 6 days when things changed.
The opening act, essentially, for the Irish War for Independence.
Absolutely, absolutely. And not only that, the pump had been primed by the change of sentiment. They say there's nothing more zealous than a convert, Kathleen. And when people change their minds about this rebellion, they really change their minds. They became emotional about it. I remember growing up in school, having very sober, rather prudish, restrained teachers, unable to talk about the Easter Rising without getting emotional. I remember my parents, who decried all expression of emotion unless it was prayer. I remember them absolutely getting hugely emotional. My mother in tears, my father close to tears, talking about the Easter Rising. That's how important it was. So it caught not only the imagination of the intellect, it caught the imagination of the soul as well.
So 100 years later, I have been reading various accounts that there may be some questions and very careful planning as to how the Irish will celebrate 2000 in 2016. It means this day different things still to different people. As you say, the memories are long and people are somewhat, I mean, not completely, of course, because there is in Ireland, but there's still a Northern Ireland, and the desire to still have Ireland be one is strong among some people.
One geographical unit, yeah.
Yeah, so how will this centenary be marked in Ireland, and how should it be marked?
Do you know, it's enormously interesting. I have three sons, and they range in age, and dear God, one of them will be 48 years old tomorrow. I can't believe it. And I looking so young. You know?
You do, Frank, you do.
Well, so I tell myself every morning. You know, Kathleen, I've stopped shaving with a blade. I've started shaving with an electric razor because I can't bear to look at that aging expression first thing in the morning. And I'm only half joking here, by the way.
Just grow a beard then. Don't worry
Absolutely.
About it.
Absolutely.
Right.
Oh, that'll make me look even older. But the boys, though they're interested, they're not as tied in any way to what was essentially a blood sacrifice. And much of the debate around the celebration of the Rising in Ireland has been around this issue, and much of the comment has been around this issue of blood sacrifice. But of course, there is a problem, because the depth and intensity of the 30 years of recent troubles in Northern Ireland and the atrocities that happened on all sides there have made people rather wary as to how you celebrate something that was in itself full of atrocity.
Yes.
No matter that it led to a freedom of 26 of the 32 counties, no matter that it led to a creation of heroes and martyrs, no matter that it led people to new heights of patriotism expressed and expressible, there's still awareness at the moment that it all had become, one man said to me that it has become tainted. I don't agree. It has become tainted by what happened in Northern Ireland since. But there's been a caution about this. So people are pivoting to the expression of what happened in 1916. The poems, the songs, the music, and memoirs have been appearing of various people. Memoirs of other women. Eyewitness women who were there in 1916 on the site at the occasion. Far more women took part in the Easter Rising than I had previously known about. And I think a lot of people in Ireland are the same. They didn't know that there were so many women involved.
Yeah, I've
There's
seen some
marvelous, marvelous witness memoirs have been published.
I've just seen some pictures of the women involved. I didn't know that either. So what?
And they were fearless.
Yes. Yes, a lot of people were fearless in all of this. So, did you do a play? I know you're speaking.
No,
in Oxford.
I was. There's a marvelous festival happening in New York. The role of America in the 1916 Rising and the aftermath is being exposed, I think, and rather well for the first time. Not many people realize that in the great American cities, when word of the executions reached the United States, in the great American cities, thousands candlelit vigils. There were special concerts in Carnegie Hall, for example.
Mm.
Extraordinary things happened. People came out, and that, of course, what did that lead to? That led to fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
People like Eamon de Valera, one of the leaders of 1916, who wasn't executed because he'd been born in the United States, been born in a pauper's hospital in New York. He was not executed, he was imprisoned, but he eventually, when he came over here to start funding the War of Independence at Michael Collins' behest, there was a sympathy waiting. And that sympathy was born then. You had these generations of Irish-Americans who had become successful and become wealthy and wanted nothing more than to support what was happening back home because they had heard the stories of a country's oppressed for centuries, not generations, for centuries. And that also happened. So the streets of the big American cities saw, so to speak, action in support of what had happened in 1916. And a lot of that is now being reflected in events that are happening in New York.
Interesting. Well, let's hear about 1916, and I want you to analyze this poem and talk about its significance. This is a very famous poem. I'm not sure who's doing the audio on this. It's maybe you'll recognize the voice, but it's nicely done, and it's W.B. Yeats' Easter 1916. Do you want to set it up for us?
I have seen them coming at the close of day. He didn't write this immediately. He didn't write this for some time afterwards. And there are interesting things in this. When he numbers them, when he numbers the leaders and reads out their names, he also names a man of whom he was profoundly jealous, John McBride, who was the husband of the woman Yeats was so passionately in love with, Maud Gonne McBride. So to speak, there's a little piece of historical gossip in here as well, if you listen closely.
Okay, let's listen to Easter 1916, and then Frank will tell us what he heard in it.
Easter 1916 by W.B. Yeats. I have met them at close of day, coming with vivid faces from counter or desk among grey 18th century houses. I have passed with a nod of the head, or polite, meaningless words, or have lingered a while and said polite, meaningless words, and thought before I had done of a mocking tale or a jibe to please a companion, around the fire at the club, being certain that they and I but lived where motley is worn, all changed, changed utterly, a terrible beauty is born. That woman's days were spent in ignorant goodwill, her nights in argument until her voice grew shrill. What voice more sweet than hers when young and beautiful she rode to harriers? This man kept a school and rode our winged horse. This other, his helper and friend, was coming into his force. He might have won fame in the end, so sensitive his nature seemed, so daring and sweet his thought. This other man I had dreamed, a drunken, vainglorious lout. He had done most bitter wrong to some who are near to my heart. Yet I number him in the song. He too has resigned his part in the casual comedy. He too has been changed in his turn, transformed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. Hearts with one purpose alone, through summer and winter seem, enchanted to a stone to trouble the living stream. The horse that comes from the road, the rider, the birds that range from cloud to tumbling cloud, minute by minute they change. A shadow of cloud on the stream changes minute by minute. A horse hoof slides on the brim, and a horse plashes within it. The long leg moorhens dive, and hens to moorcocks call. Minute by minute they live, the stones in the midst of all. Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. Oh, when may it suffice? That is heaven's part, our part, to murmur name upon name, as a mother names her child when sleep at last has come on limbs that had run wild. What is it but nightfall? No, no, not night, but death. Was it needless death after all? For England may keep faith, for all that is done and said. We know their dream enough to know they dreamed and are dead. But what if excess of love bewildered them till they died? I rout it out in a verse, MacDonagh and MacBride and Connolly and Pierce, now and in time to be, wherever green is worn, are changed, changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born.
Easter 1916. The line we remember, certainly, well, a couple of them, "A terrible beauty is born," and also "There's too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart." It's a very, very deep, boy, talk about remembering
beautiful
things
reading.
For a long time.
Beautiful reading,
it is
Kathy.
Beautiful. I don't know who it is.
I don't know either. I thought I recognized the voice as being a very well-known Abbey actor from Dublin, but I'm not sure, but it's absolutely good. It's as nice a reading as I've ever heard, actually.
Yeah, well, we'll find
beautifully
out.
Beautifully chosen.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, I mean, the vainglorious lout was the man McBride that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Patrick Pearce was one of the leaders who had a school. He was a lawyer, he was a courtroom lawyer, a barrister. He argued in court. And he was one of the leaders. Pearce is the man who read the proclamation of the Irish Republic on the steps of the post office at noon on Easter Monday, the first day of the rising, the famous proclamation, which is now sort of enshrined in all Irish schools, and everybody in Ireland has seen it or read it or something. And it begins, "Irish men and Irish women, in the name of God and of the dead generations from which she derives her tradition of nationhood." And it was a very potent moment. But the poem itself, Yeats's writing of it, it's quite extraordinary if you knew who or what Yeats was. Yeats was part of the ruling ascendancy classes, the Protestant classes. He wasn't an aristocrat. His family were aristocrats. Indeed, his father was a distinguished artist, and so was his brother. But for Yeats to write that poem would be, just extraordinary, an extraordinary move across. There are lines in there that betray who and what his sympathies were, who
yes.
was and what his sympathies were. "For England may keep faith." The fact is that England didn't keep faith. They were forced to keep faith by public opinion. That's what actually happened. But the actual fact that he wrote it and included in it women whom he admired, the woman who wrote to Hans, that was Constance Markovic's, one of the Gorbu's, sister from Sligo, where Yeats's mother's family came from. There is in there a kind of little biography of the people, a kind of who's who of some of the people who took part in the rising. And the thrust of the poem, the spiritual thrust of the poem, that somehow, somewhere, at some times, revolution is necessary, no matter what terrible beauty it breeds. That's, to me, where the actual poetic instinct resides. And if I never liked Yeats for anything else, I would take my hat off to him for that alone.
He's not bad with some other poems either.
Oh, my.
Oh, my, yes. Tell me about your podcast, your James Joyce podcast. What year are you in? How many people do you have listening?
Oh,
why did
dear.
You start
God,
it?
Kathleen.
Please
right.
tell us.
Tell me when you first encountered James Joyce.
High school.
Right. What were you given to read?
Probably the Dubliners.
Probably the Dubliners. But you've encountered Ulysses.
Frank, I haven't read it yet. I hate to admit it.
Okay.
Every year
you
I say this, I'm
you know how many people in the world say that in exactly that tone of voice? People
yes.
feel
okay.
they should have read it.
I know.
And those who have started it are guilty for not having finished it, for not being able to get past the opening sentence of Chapter 3, which is ineluctable modality of the visible. And with a sentence like that, who in heaven's name can blame them for not being able to get past it, right?
You're right.
Many, many years ago, I was living in London, and the Joyce centenary was coming up, and people started asking me about Joyce, and I realized that I knew very little about him, because, of course, he was frowned on in our house. He was an old blasphemer. And indeed, my mother referred to him as an old blasphemer all the time.
Did she?
So I thought, I've never finished Ulysses, and I thought I'd better finish Ulysses. And I found I couldn't understand it. So I thought, there's only one way to understand this book, and that is force myself to write a book about it. Analyzing the book, not in any huge, long way, but giving people a kind of primer to Ulysses, a kind of getting people into it painlessly and without fear, removing the guilt. So I wrote this book called James Joyce's Odyssey, A Guide to the Dublin of Ulysses, using the city where the book is set as my main way through this labyrinth. And to my absolute astonishment, the book went up to number 2 or number 3 in the bestseller list.
Ooh.
So I knew there was an appetite.
Right.
But fast forward then to the year. That was 1981, 82. It took me a little while to get going. Fast forward to 2010. And my publishers tell me, as every writer's publisher tell them, well, you really should have a website. You really should have an internet presence. I thought, well, what can I do as an internet presence? I started putting up writing tips every day. I did 365 writing tips a year for 3 or 4 years, and they're all still up there on the internet. And then I thought, hey, what about that Joyce thing? And I started doing these podcasts, determining to explain Ulysses phrase by phrase. The object of the exercise was to do these podcasts in such a way that by the time I had finished them, then the forecast was 28 years. By the time I had finished them, it's my hedge against dementia, I told everybody. By the time I had finished them, there would not be a phrase in Ulysses that remained obscure. And I thought this was great. And now I find that probably sometime in the next 10 days, we will have hit 2 million downloads.
Wonderful.
Two million. Can you believe that? We have listeners in Uzbekistan. I have listeners in South Africa. I'm a one-man band. I'm the loudest one-man band in the world. You know, I'm beginning to sound like Donald Trump when I talk about this. When I talk about, I can say I'm huge, you know.
And you are in so many fields.
But the fact is, and it has taken me by surprise, and I cannot think about it without bursting into delighted laughter, because it proves the point. It proves that if you package things for people in a way they can enjoy and approach without guilt and feel warm towards, you can achieve massive, massive educational penetration. And that's exactly what's happening. Mm. You should see the letters I get. You should see the emails I get. They're astonishing.
Oh, I'm so glad, Frank.
They're astounding. You know? And it's just a labor, for me, it's a labor of love. And I'm now up to doing a page at a time. And some of the podcasts are 20, 25 minutes long.
Haven't you had a good life?
I guess so. You know, I don't think of it like that. I have to tell you that I do really love getting up in the morning.
Good.
I do really love going to my desk every day. I can't wait for Monday mornings. And Sunday afternoon, I'm rubbing my hands because Monday morning is coming, because I know I'm going to have another week of all kinds of things. And I'm learning all the time from this mighty book, because Joyce's references are legion. They are multiple. And every single one of them teaches me something. All kinds of stuff. Music hall songs, vaudeville songs from the 19th century, old phrases, you know, old ballads, Latin sayings. I'm learning all kinds of stuff. And that's only part of my life. The rest of my life is pretty full as well.
Frank Delaney, he certainly does have a full life, is our guest for this St. Patrick's Day, and we certainly welcome your phone calls. We have more poems to hear. We have music to hear. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. It's St. Patrick's Day, and Frank Delaney accepted our invitation to join us again this year, and we're delighted to have him with us. He has, what a mind he has, and he's been just an incredibly prolific author. He is the author of the bestseller Ireland, but he's written many, many other books, sequels to that, so he's looked at the whole history of Ireland in the novels that he's written. He has been a news reporter for the BBC, covering some very difficult political situations in Northern Ireland. He hosted his own talk show. He had a program about language. He's created a five-minute podcast, a page-by-page analysis, although sometimes it's more than 5 minutes because he's doing more work on that. It's of James Joyce's Ulysses. He's just a treasure, and we're delighted to have him with us and have for the past several St. Patrick's Days. So let's welcome some phone calls for him. Eugene and Viola, hello.
Well, good afternoon, Kathleen. It's Mr. Delaney.
Hello.
I have two questions that are unrelated. During World War II, Ireland was neutral, and they wouldn't let the British use their seaports, if I'm correct. But didn't they supply weather information to the Allies for the Normandy landing with weather stations off their coast? That's the first question. Second one is, to obtain Irish citizenship, does it have to be your grandfather or can it be your great-grandfather?
I think it's at grandfather level, Eugene. I'm not quite certain, but I can tell you how to find out. It's very, very easy to find out. You go onto the Internet and you Google Dublin Castle, which, along with the Mormons in Salt Lake City in Utah, is one of the finest genealogical tracers in the world.
Great.
And they will tell you what the eligibility is. So will the Department of Foreign Affairs website, if you Google that. Or government, I think it's government.ie is the generic website for the government in Ireland. As to the question about the war, well, that, as I've heard it, and I don't know if this is true, this is unverified information, but I'll pass it on to you what I was told. I was told that the Irish at the time realized that there would be massive sensitivity about giving weather reports in neutrality, keeping the country neutral, about giving weather reports to England. So they gave them to America.
Oh,
it was the same war, it was the same allies, but they gave them to the Americans by telegraph and not to the English. Hmm. So that's how they got around that. Talk about a splitting of hairs.
Really? Barbara sends this email. She's going to Ireland in April. When she picked her travel date, she was unaware of the 100th anniversary of the uprising, and she's not quite sure how to word this, she says, but when I talk with people in Ireland, she's wondering if there's anything that she should be mindful of or sensitive to.
The internet at the moment, anything coming out of Ireland at the moment, especially the Irish Times newspaper, is full of detail about celebrations that are on. If she's going around the time of the celebrations, which is around the 20th of April, and that kicks off 5 years, by the way, of commemoration. Now, 5 years, because you have the War of Independence, and you have the Treaty, and you have the Civil War, and then you have the First Parliament, all of that. She should be aware that she will come across some absolutely terrific, iconic concerts that will be remembered for many, many years. And in those concerts, she will learn anything she needs to know about the rising. She should absolutely go to the General Post Office in the middle of Dublin,
yes,
O'Connell Street, because it will be located there. And I'm told, I haven't seen them myself, I'm told there are some wonderful exhibits coming up in the National Museum in Kildare Street.
Mm. Have a wonderful trip. I'm sure you will.
It's a great time to
yes
go. She's been. If she came, she wasn't astute, then she's been very lucky.
Yes. Teresa in Madison, hi.
Hi, I was brought up in an Irish household in Kilburn, London. I'm now living here on the Mersey, and my parents were very pro-IRA, so I was brought up with many stories. But the first time I read something that really brought it home to me was a book by Ernie O'Malley called The Singing Flame, and I wondered whether he had read that. And the second point is that my grandfather had fought in the First World War under English generals, and when those generals came back to Ireland, it turns out they're fighting the very same people that fought under them in the First World War.
Exactly right.
So I just wanted to know his comments on that.
That's exactly right. First of all, Ernie O'Malley. Ernie O'Malley is a major figure, a poet at heart, although he chose to write mostly in prose. He wrote two great books, The Singing Flame and On Another Man's Wound. He's, to my mind, he is the best of the poetic writers on 1916, the men who wrote poetically in prose. His writing is wonderful. Mm. It's completely searingly honest. It really does get you into the mood and the feeling of the time. I couldn't recommend him more highly, and you're very lucky to have read him because I think he's out of print now, although I think a lot of those books are coming back into print at the moment. As to the disposition of the forces, it was quite extraordinary. I mean, several of the British soldiers on the streets in Dublin during the week, Easter week of 1916, were from Dublin. There were young lads there who had been recruited into the British Army and who hadn't quite gone to France, and they were sent to Ireland. And in some cases, they weren't sure whether they were firing on their own family. I've not yet seen the authentication, but I'm told there's very good authentication for this. But it's completely understandable and doesn't surprise me in any way that some of those generals would have come back to Ireland and be seeing the same faces all over again.
And what about the Germans' involvement in all of this?
They tried to get involved, and the Irish and the IRA tried to get them involved in running guns, but they were intercepted every single time. And the history of Ireland versus England, so to speak, has been that the Irish sought allies in Europe everywhere they could. When the Irish chieftains were deposed and dispossessed of their lands and expelled in the repeated attempts at genocide in Ireland, they went and fought for every foreign army that was having some kind of dispute with England. They fought in all the armies everywhere where they were likely to fight against the English. In France, for example, they were rewarded with land, and they always seemed to try and choose vineyards. So you have Hennessy Cognac, you've Haut-Brion, which I think is O'Brien, you have Barton, you have all kinds of, you have Phelan, you have Kirwan. These are all well-known vineyards in Bordeaux. These were all Irish chieftains who fought for France against England. So that continued. So they looked for allies everywhere they could in Europe, Italy, Spain, Portugal. I mean, the Spanish Armada of the 1580s that founded off Ireland was supposed to help a complete revolution in Ireland. In 1798, the French came into the west of Ireland and founded at the hands of Lord Cornwallis and his soldiers in the battles in which they were subsequently engaged. Always, 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 there was a look to Europe for alliance against England. And it was easy to get allies because everybody in Europe was fighting against the English. The English were by nature a very belligerent nation and had fought everybody and were still fighting everybody. I think they've made war. I think they are the country with a record of making more war against more people than anybody else on earth. So therefore, when the Irish were looking for allies, they didn't have far to look.
Right. Matt sent this email. I've seen posts suggesting that historically the Irish were the most mistreated people in America and that there were Irish slaves in America. I know there were Irish indentured servants, and I'm sure there were many examples of horrible treatment of the Irish, but I simply don't see their mistreatment on the same level as the genocide of natives or the chattel slavery of Africans. Am I wrong?
If you wanted to have a hierarchy of mistreatment in America, it would have to be the Native Americans first. The Irish would come in second. In the 1600s, the various British monarchs tried to remove most of the menfolk out of Ireland. They exported 550,000 men as slaves to the West Indies and to the southern states of America. And there are many reports of the slaves working on the Mississippi, the Irish slaves taking orders from the African American slaves. So in the pecking order of American slavery, the Irish were at the lowest point. All up and down the Hudson River, for example, the patroons had houses which were serviced and farms which were serviced by Irish slaves. They might have called them indentured servants, but this is how indenturing worked. And I've been working on this for some time. This is how indenturing worked. You were recruited. You were rounded up in Ireland, and you were offered your passage to America. You never saw the money. They paid the ship. And then the passage, if it was £10, for example, the wage that was set for you in the farm of which you went to work along the Hudson, owned by one of the Dutch patroons, perhaps, or a cotton plantation in the south, the wage that was set at you was kept by your employer to pay off your fare to America, and it would take 60 years to pay it off at the wage he had struck for you. Ooh. You never saw a penny, so you were, in fact, a slave. They didn't call them slaves, but there were slaves. There were actual named Irish slaves. I think I'm right in saying that the first slave revolt in the United States was in the state of Connecticut, and it was led by an Irishman who led 11 other slaves, all African-Americans, away from a farm, and they were never caught. They were never found again.
Oh, there should be a movie about that. Do a documentary.
I know, but it is absolutely true to say that the first slaves in the continent of North America were the Irish.
Thanks very much for the question. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and Frank Delaney is our guest. He has been. He's our traditional St. Patrick's Day guest because he knows so much, and he's so literary, and he's written so many books about Ireland, knows the history and the poetry and the music, and we'll move into more discussion of poetry. I do traditional things on St. Patrick's Day always, and I always read to myself. I don't read it to myself. I read by myself, out loud to myself. And my dog this year, Seamus Heaney, so I want to play that. Frank knows I love this poem. And we'll ask Frank to give us a poem if he would like to, and you as well. Send along your St. Patrick's Day greetings. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Happy St. Patrick's Day, Frank Delaney continues with us in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Frank Delaney is our guest this hour, and Frank is our St. Patrick's Day guest always. He is known as the most eloquent man in the world. He's the author, New York Times bestseller, Ireland, many books following that. We've talked to him about many of those. He's been a broadcaster, a documentarian, had his own talk show, has interviewed 3,500 of the world's greatest writers, and he is here He is here now. And we will go to Colin in Janesville. Hi, Colin.
Hey, how are you?
Fine. How are you? Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, why, thank you. Yeah, so my name is actually Colin Callahan. I'm historically Irish, but I don't know much about the history and the people. So my question is, why were the Irish selected to be kind of picked on by the rest of Europe? Why were the Irish chosen to be the first slaves in North America?
Well, it was entirely had to do with the relationship with England. They were our nearest neighbor. Ireland has always been an extremely fertile country, enormously fertile. So therefore, it was a kind of breadbasket. It was like the Romans moving up into France under Julius Caesar. It was a kind of a breadbasket. But the Irish didn't take it lying down. We're rebellious people, and we didn't like our land being taken from us. And the history of the land being taken from us is something that's not generally known. You were a farmer in Ireland in the late 1500s, and you had a good farm, and you farmed it well. And then suddenly one morning you saw a troop of red-coated soldiers riding up the road, and a family coming after them on carts. And the soldiers arrived at your house, and they said, okay, get you and your family out. You're leaving here. This farm now belongs to these people. Exactly what the Nazis did with the Jewish properties in Germany. And it was an effort, really, to bring the country totally under the British crown, because even though it was governed by England, it wasn't an obedient country. And, most important, the Irish did not accept the reformation of King Henry VIII. The Irish stayed Catholic and wanted their allegiance to Rome to survive and to stay that way. And, of course, that was part that inflamed the crown in England, where they had a vested interest in making sure that everybody was Protestant, because it's easier to rule people when they all believe the same things. And that was how much of it continued. But it had started long before that, and every attempt to subdue the Irish totally had always failed, and then it just escalated and escalated and escalated, and finally there came a moment when they started trying to get the people off the land completely and deporting them. And as I say, something like 550,000 Irish, I think, were deported in the 1600s. Mm.
What should Colin read, other than your book, your wonderful bestseller, Ireland, and all the subsequent books, to get a good history of his ancestors?
There's a historian whom I love called Joseph Lee, L-E-E.
Okay.
He's written the best histories of Ireland. You know, his reach, his look, his overall view of Ireland is very, very accurate. It's the Ireland I know. It is the country that I know and love and grew up in, and where I heard stories literally from everybody all the time, because Ireland is a great storytelling nation. And that's a great way in. But, you know, read the novelists, read Edna O'Brien, read William Trevor, read Seamus Heaney's poetry.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to guide to the feeling and the spirit of Ireland as you will ever come across.
Mm-hmm.
And William Butler Yeats the same.
Mm-hmm. Can I play a Seamus Heaney poem?
That's a good idea.
I love Seamus Heaney.
You should do.
Okay. This is Seamus Heaney, and it's one of my favorite poems by him. Seamus Heaney, of course, a very important figure in 20th century literature, and this is a poem. It's read by him, which I also like the fact that it's read by him. It's one that many can relate to of all ages. He was raised in Northern Ireland and lived for many years in Dublin, and won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1995. He died in 2013. This is his poem. I play every St. Patrick's Day. I'm so traditional. It's called Digging.
Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean rasping sound, when the spade sinks into gravelly ground, my father digging. I look down till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug. The shaft against the inside knee was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in our hands. By God, the old man could handle a spade, just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Once I carried him milk in a bottle, corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell to right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down and down for the good turf, digging. The cold smell of potato mould, the squelch and slap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it.
I love that. Why are there so many Seamus Heaneys and William Butler Yeats and James Joyce's and the list goes on, and Frank Delaney's, for that matter, that come from Ireland, Frank?
Well, you know, there's a thing, there's a line in there, Kathy, that explains a huge amount, specifically about Heaney, but about a lot of other poems as well, a lot of poets as well, I should say. Could handle in Toner's Bog. He cut more turf in Toner's Bog.
Mm-hmm.
Only Heaney knew where Toner's Bog was. The bog was on bogland owned by a farmer called Toner, who rented out sides of peat, sides of turf, for people to dig. It's such an extraordinarily local reference. And that's the point about Heaney, and that's the point about Joyce. They understood something, one of the great fundamental truths of life, that in the particular is the universal.
Mm-hmm.
You are every woman. I am every man.
Mm-hmm.
We may be individual and have our own stories, but you're an individual who is your story, and only you can tell it, and only you know it, and nobody can tell it like you can, and nobody has the right to. And I'm the same. And that's the thing the Irish understood. This tiny island, 33,000 square miles, this tiny island, smaller than I think than Ohio, or some of the big, big vowel states, as I call them, this tiny island out there had to have an individual personality. And that's the truth that gave them that personality. They understood that we were the same as everybody else. So Toner's Bog becomes a line in a poem that becomes famous. This piece, this scrabby piece of land in the northern half of Ireland that nobody but the poet knew.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that answer. Why did you leave? I know you get back often, but why did you leave? And does it do you still have your heartstrings pulling you back?
You can't really work. If you're a writer, you can't work in Ireland. I remember having a conversation, at least I couldn't, I remember having a conversation about this with Anthony Burgess. He said he tried living in Dublin for a while. He said, then you go to the pub at night time, he said, they tell you what you're working on. He said, and then you tell them the story, the whole bloody novel. He said, and then you can't go home and write it because you've told the story. It's distance lends enchantment to the
yes.
view, is an
mm-hmm.
old saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly needed the distance. I think I always knew I was going to leave. I think I knew that since I was very young. And I think I also knew that I was eventually heading here to America. I grew up with an enormous consciousness of the United States in my head and in my heart. I read American comics. Saturday Evening Post used to come to our house every week. We had cousins in America. There's nobody in Ireland. I've never met any Irish person who doesn't have a relative in North America. You may ask them, do you have any relatives in North America? No, will come the answer. But my mother has a cousin there. So there was a consciousness of America. And, you know, certainly at the moment, there is no more interesting country in the world in which to live. That is for sure.
Lynn on Facebook writes, part of my husband's family came on the Mayflower, but my family contends that we Irish were in Virginia as slaves not too long after. My grandmother remembers signs saying Irish need not apply. Is any of this family lore true? How can I find out more about it? We were from County Armagh and County Cork.
That's an interesting call. That's an interesting communication. And to tell you why that's interesting, because there were various reasons for migration from Ireland to the United States. And one of the least known is a migration for reasons of religious persecution. When the Reformation happened, and when what were called derogatorily the low churches began to form, the Presbyterians, the Methodists, the Baptists, the people who followed John Calvin and John Knox and Martin Luther, when all of that began to spread across Europe, and those churches formed in Ireland, they were driven out of the north part of Ireland by the Episcopalians. So the first religious persecution in Ireland
was not Protestant against Catholic, but what we call Protestant, Episcopalian, against Protestant, Baptist, Methodist, and Presbyterian. Hmm. In actual fact, and a lot of them came, and they settled in states like Virginia and West Virginia and Kentucky and Tennessee. And they were all, you know, they all admired the Dutch King, William of Orange, for example, because he fought for them in Northern Ireland. He fought against the establishment, King Billy. And every one of them had a family member called William or Billy. And they clung together in enclaves up in the forests of Kentucky and Tennessee. And they became known as the Hillbillies. And that's the origin of that term. Hmm. So her family is possibly part of the long descent of that migration. And if there were slaves, if she'd heard there were slaves, she's almost certainly right. Because that seems to me one of the very few ways in which the idea of slavery having existed in the United States was preserved. The official record is very, very thin indeed. And I ought to know, because I've been digging into it now for several
years. Yes, I know you have. Nick in Crandon, hi.
Hi. So I am a member of a tribe in northern Wisconsin. And it just kind of strikes me as historically kind of inaccurate that Europeans continue to kind of ignore that North America had its own population of people. And we know from stories and our oral history that native tribes did indeed enslave other native tribes. So it just kind of strikes me as inaccurate that the first recorded slaves in North America were Irish.
All right, Frank.
Well, I don't know that the Native Americans were actually enslaved, were they? I have no knowledge of that. You may be right, but I've always understood that the Native Americans, I think the way the Europeans treated the Native Americans is one of the great scandals of the world, and we all know that, I think. And it's just absolutely appalling and continues to be in terms of historical memory. But I'm not sure that I've ever heard that Native Americans were actually slaves to any Europeans settling here. Were they, do you know?
Sorry, I think that I said that in miscommunication. That Native Americans actually, some tribes would, after warfare, enslave other Native tribes.
Other Native American tribes.
All right. What I really mean about the Irish slaves is that they were enslaved by the people who were colonizing the United States.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call.
Good call, though.
Yeah. How should we celebrate St. Patrick's Day? The way we celebrate it is just terrible. Everybody goes out and drinks too much, and it's rowdy, and there's so much more to this whole culture, Frank.
Yeah.
I know.
Well, you've heard me rail about this before, Kathy.
So go ahead and rail. Okay.
Yeah. when you see people drinking to excess on St. Patrick's Day, because it is believed that that is an Irish expression, that is, call it what it is, that is racism. It is a conforming to a stereotype that they believe is true. It is not true. We're way down on the league table of European drinkers. Way down. But, you know, give a dog a bad name, and you'll whip him for life. Mm. That's what they say. And that's why this happens. You don't see it happening in Dublin on St. Patrick's Day. Or if you do, it's frowned on, and it's not to the same extent. It's dying off here, but some people have taken stands against it. The mayor of Hoboken, for example, in New Jersey, who's a very smart woman, she has banned the St. Patrick's Parade because of public drunkenness.
Oh.
And she says, you know, she said some years ago, a stand has to be taken against this.
Mm-hmm. Read poetry.
And it's not, you know, it's not exactly.
Yeah, listen to music. Frank, we're out of time. I love talking to you on St. Patrick's Day. So I'll say same time again next year?
Like all good conversations, we could go on all night, Kathy.
I know we could. Thank you, Frank. Come to Milwaukee sometime. Thank you. You as
Take
well.
Care.
Frank Delaney, our guest. He's our traditional guest on St. Patrick's Day, and we love talking to him. His book is Ireland, the first one, if you want to start with that. He's written many, many others, and he's doing this really interesting podcast on James Joyce Ulysses. Look up his name, Frank Delaney, Delaney, and he can take you to all kinds of pastures. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour and to Kendra Smith for on-air production, and a very happy St. Patrick's Day to you.